thank you very much for introducing me, and thank you for doing service and everybody else who serves and makes this meeting possible. My name is Brian, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My recovery date, just as a reference point, I suppose, is the 1st of May, 1982. So, and from that day to this day, I've been completely sober and clean from alcohol and all mood-altering substances, apart from coffee. And so that's my recovery date. You should never tell an old person to take as long as they like, because we old folk love to talk. And given half a chance, I can talk for Ireland, not only Ireland, for a large part of Western Europe. So I'll try to keep it reasonably short. So not to go on and on and on. So, but because it's been taped, I thought it's a little bit different. Normally, I share for myself, you know, and if what I say can be of any help to anybody else, great. But this time, if it's going to be taped, I thought I'd do something I've never done in giving chair. I've actually got some notes. I've took some notes just to give a sort of a shape to my story, because if I don't, it's not really a stream of consciousness, it's more a spew of consciousness. And it might make any sense. So I thought I had to make some notes, and I thought I'd find a sort of a shape to explain all my experiences in AA. So I usually, when I'm at a meeting, somebody says something, and I sort of hear something, and my imagination grabs it, and it opens the door in my mind, and I sort of form a story out of it. So a couple of months ago, I heard somebody at a meeting say that their life is fairly threadbare. And I thought, well, my life isn't. It's not a threadbare. And I started thinking then of the different threads in my life, you know. And then I thought that there's three phases. There's before I picked up a drink, all during the time that I drank, and from the time I put down the drink in almost 40 years ago, when I had my last drink and my last drug. And, you know, a lot has happened in that. I'm 70 now. A lot has happened in that life. You know, so I thought I'd use that as a way to help me to try to formulate something that might make sense. So looking at threads. So I suppose one of the earlier threads, and one of the threads that goes from probably before I was born up to right now, is the trauma. I come from a background that is very abusive. My background was very, now we would call it a dysfunctional family. And but then it was very, very violent, a lot of violence and emotional and sexual misconduct. And that caused my brain to evolve along a divergent path. And it left lots of symptoms. And I was launched into the world as a young adult with a lot of very strange rules about who I was and about how the world is and what sort of a world I'm in. So that's been a sort of theme that's run through my whole life. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but in the context of you know, how being sober, how what that means, how to be sober and how to live a sober life with the legacy of what they call now adverse childhood experience. But one of the main symptoms of that plagued me for a long time was something I rarely talk about in AA, and it was a really bad stammer. I had as a child, I stuttered very badly. In Ireland, we use the word, we call it a stutter. In the UK, it's called a stammer. So I used to call it, I used the word stammer for a long time, because the word stutter, it's a horrible word. And it's like, it could be like glass. So whenever I thought, well, I'm going, I'm going to own this, you know, this word. So, you know, own the stuff. And it's a thing that when I was, before I drank in school, it was torture in school. And in those enlightened days, we had the teacher who thought his way to help us was, there were a couple of us in my class who got a bad stutters, and he would stand behind us in the line and ask us to read out stuff. And if we got a block, we get bashed across the back of the head. And that was his way. Of course, it didn't help. You know, it made it worse. So it was something that it was, as a child, it was horrible. And I never really, you know, I couldn't do anything about it. I did go to a sort of child guidance clinic, you know, to get some help. But that made me feel very different to everybody else. And that was a theme that's been replicated through my life for a long time, of feeling different, of not being the same as. That's just something about me that was a bit odd, you know. And the stammer was something that it was very bad, and I drank. And when I was drinking, there were long times where I just couldn't talk. I forgot how to how to talk, and I just couldn't talk, and I would point, and at a beer, you know, a tap, I'd pint a beer and mimic a pint and just point, and it worked. And then I got sober, and then I came to AA, and you know, it was all about talk, words, you know, and words for me, it was like trying to cough up a broken glass and rusty fucking barbed wire. So words were always something I never felt safe about. So yes, in AA, it was about words, talking. And I didn't open my mouth in an AA meeting for almost 5 years. I didn't say a word in an AA meeting, but I did talk to people after the meetings. I would go out and we would have the meeting after the meeting, and I would listen. And then I would make the occasional comment, and then I got to know people. I got to feel safe around the rooms, especially sponsors. I was very lucky. I had some very good sponsors who were kind and very patient, and you know, who were very supportive, and I could talk. And then I sort of got used to talk. And then my stutter went from being it was no longer overt. It became covert. So my I stutter now in my mind. And not so much in my, language. But one of the consequences of that is that my voice never feels like it's my voice. And for a long time, I felt if I was talking, whatever I was saying always felt fake, because the voice, it never felt like it was my real voice. I'm so mindful of the dangerous words that I'm always have to think five or six words ahead to avoid any of the dangerous words. But there were times in AA, and it was only in AA really, that I sort of, I would talk and I'd say, oh, that's actually a different voice. It's my voice. And I began to get a sense of, you know, being real and being honest and being open and all these things that I thought I would never, never get, you know. So today it still happens. I still get the blocks. Sometimes people are really, really cruel, and they laugh, or they joke. And I used to get enraged at that. I don't anymore. I just feel a terrible sadness that, you know, no, it's there, and then I move on. You know, it's part of my life. So it's building, you know, it's a part of my life now. I've done loads of work on it, but it's only a part of my life now. It isn't all of me. So that's a thread. Is one thread that's gone from before I was drank all throughout my drinking and up to now. And being sober has informed that. And being sober and being clean gives me the tools to be able to do something about it. And largely, you know, my work now is concerned with voice. You know, I use my voice as my main working tool. So now I quite like talking. And, you know, I can easily talk in these meetings, and it's okay. And if I do get a block, as I do, no, it's fine. I know that nobody's gonna be horrified or tell me to go, never darken these rooms again, wait my terrible shadow. You know, it's not likely that'll happen. So it's just one of those things now. It's just an aspect. So being sober has allowed that to for me to own that part of myself. Another thread that's been there ever before I picked up a drink was being gay. You know, I always knew I was gay from the age of five. I knew I was gay, and it always felt right. You know, it felt perfectly right. I first time I ever had any sort of feeling was I was 5 years of age. I was in low babies, and I saw a guy in the sandpit, a boy in my class, and I just had a fascination about this boy, a real fascination. I wanted to gaze at him and to be next to him and to talk to him. And that sort of a passionate interest followed me throughout my whole life. I hadn't any idea where I was going. Now, this was back in the 50s, and sex hadn't been invented in Ireland yet. Sex wasn't invented in Ireland until 1961. It was the BBC, actually, who invented sex in Ireland. Those pagans, you know, and so I hadn't a clue. No, I didn't have any language for those feelings, but I knew it was right. I knew it felt completely pure and completely right. But at the same time, I knew never talk about this, you know, never talk this, and never let anybody know. And again, I was different, you know, it, this sense of being pretty different and having a different way. Came out as being gay in 1969. You know, I was drugging and at the time and drinking. I was out and very, very, very loudly out. And I moved over to Holland in 1971 to find love and peace. Man, I was an old hippie, so I went over to find love and peace. Didn't find love and peace. I found sex and I found a lot of drugs. It's not the same. Nothing. It's not the same. And And I got sober. I got sober in London, and I got involved in a London gay men's group. And in London, in those days, that was in 1982. There weren't many meetings around. There weren't any LGBT meetings around. And in those days, it was just called the gay group. And then it became the gay and lesbian group, and then the or lesbian and gay group, and then the LGB and the LGBT and LGBTQ. And great, the more the merrier. Open that door as wide as possible and invite many people in. It's a big, big tent. And so that became my whole life, the London gay groups, and I formed a powerful friendships there that have existed this day, you know, and that's where I began to learn how to be sober. So that thread was important. One interesting part of that was in the Irish language, the Irish word for a man, a man is a far, and it's spelled F-E-A-R. Which is the same as fear, and the men is so the Irish word for men is for a man is fear, and I went to our buildings with fear over the door to try to find love, and all I found was shame. You know, I found this terrible shame in these places where I was looking for love, and I went to places, you know, where that had fear on the door, that had men on the door, and I didn't find love. I found shame, and that was another layer of this awful shame that I felt. And I think I might have mentioned this last week or something recently. I felt like it was a sort of changeling. I'd always thought there was something so wrong about me. That there must be something wrong. There must be a reason for it. And then as a young boy, I heard the story of a changeling. And a changeling, as I'm sure you know, is when the fairies come and they take away a human child and they leave a fairy. And it's often an old fairy who's got no use. And in Irish, in Ireland, in the mythology in Ireland, up to very, very recently, fairies are not like the fairies in Disneyland. You know, they're very powerful forces, and they're very strong, and they're malignant, and you don't fuck with the fairies in Ireland. So you know, being a fairy, you know, being it or changeling, and you know, it sort of made sense. So I was there was something really bad in me, something had been, you know, the real me was lost, gone with the fairies. It was taken away, and I would never see it again. What was left for this is sort of malignant, not human thing, is or changeling. So you know, I was convinced of that, and I never thought that I could ever have any sort of a life. I thought that the best I could ever hope for would be some sort of half life, where I could you know, mimic being a human. Today, you know, after a lot of work in AF, a lot of work on myself, that is not the case today. I do feel a human. You know, I feel like an ordinary, decent human being today. So our changeling is a thing. Is it's just a story now. You know, I don't feel anymore. You know, the another, I suppose, thread in my story, first of time, another thread in my story is being an atheist. So I was an atheist long before I ever picked up a drink. You know, as I reached the age of reason, you know, as a child, this is a load of rubbish. And I left her. I was you know, a Catholic, an Irish Catholic, of course, and I served as an altar boy at Mass. And I was sort of a holy boy. You know, I'd intuited on a codependent level that if I said I was going to be a priest, that people would like me and they would approve of me. So I had a vocation to be a priest, and I wanted to be a Franciscan monk. And people said, oh, very good, you're a very good boy. And they are pat me on the head, and especially old ladies and are pat me on the head. Ah, sure, he's a lovely boy, he'll make a lovely priest, sure, he'll make his mammy proud, won't he? You know, and I still had to reach the age of reason, I suppose, you know, that all went. So I became a spitting atheist. You know, I was anti everything. No, it was a hatred driven. And when I came to AA at the end of my drinking, I was a sort of a toothless atheist. You know, I had no fight left in me. You know, I'd lost my teeth, but I was an atheist still. And I remember vividly feeling, for the first time in my life, I felt at home in the AA rooms. You know, I'd go to these rooms and something had said, I feel at peace here. I feel that this is my home. I'd never felt that in my whole life. In my family home was a very dangerous place. I never felt safe. A school was an absolute nightmare, and everything was always dangerous. I never felt safe anywhere, but I did feel safe in AA rooms. And people would invite me back, or welcome me back week after week and say, hello, Brian, it's good to see you. Welcome back. And they remembered my name and they shook my hands and they hugged me. So, you know, I felt safe. I was terrified of going back out and picking up a drink. And I was terrified that AA wouldn't work. I was terrified that, like everything else in my life, I was going to fuck this up. No, I was going to make a mess of this. So, you know, I saw the 12 steps, you know, in this huge sort of banner, in a sort of Gothic script. And God, 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 is, oh my God. again, I'm done for, you know. I really felt I was really scared, you know, of leaving or walking out. You know, I'll show you, and then I'll go back out and drink. And there wasn't much left in me at that time. You know, I was my drink at that time was very, very, very dangerous. And I've been in that hospital many, many times. And so I was on the very, very edges of madness. I was just about to go over the edge and be mad. So I was terrified of being mad. There was enough of me left. There was enough of me sane. So I was scared of admitting away. So I said, okay, I'll just do what works for me. And I had very good sponsors who said, you know, it's like a supermarket in here. You just come and take what you want and then leave the rest. So I took the steps that made sense to me. So step one made perfect sense. Step four and five made sense to me. Step eight and nine made perfect sense to me. So I did the steps that made sense to me. And then the rest I just parked. I parked the religious steps. And then over time then, you know, I just I got more and more separated from the non-secular steps, if you like, and so I began to feel, you know, and I didn't want. I still felt part of AA, and I felt I was doing the right thing, and I was involved in AA, but I didn't want to shut the door. In case I was wrong, you know, I tried to keep an open mind. I even went as far as spending seven years as a Buddhist monk. You know, I lived in particular monasteries in the UK, in Wales mainly, and then in Norwich. And I lived the life of a Buddhist monk, because our Buddhist told me that it's atheist and there is no God. In Buddhism, and the people were really nice as well. They were lovely people, and it was Western Buddhism, and they were trying to combine the our Buddha and Nietzsche and Freud, and it was really smart people, and they were really kind, really kind, and they replicated what I found in AA. Really lovely people who were reaching out within a hand of friendship and the eye of kindness. And that kept me, and that sort of humanized me, because I was very feral when I came around the room first. And all the decent people who reached out and liked me and loved me before I could learn how to like myself, that sort of humanized me. And that was very, very important. So the our Buddhist phase, although I did that because I didn't want to mess up my involvement in MNAA, and I wanted to keep an open mind. Of itself, it was a very important part of my our journey. And then after about 7 or 8 years, my mother died, and I went through it, you know, there was sort of an angry phase, and I moved away. And but it's still, I value those our times a lot. And I met some wonderful folk there, you know, who I'm in contact with to this day still. In time, I began to move away from the 12 steps and to focus more on the fellowship of AA. And so that's where I am now. You know, I'm very much committed to the fellowship of AA. I'm very much committed to the secular steps. And it was interesting, but at one time I was doing some research on the 12 steps, and I came across a letter written by Bill W. something, I think it was 1947, and it was his first version of the 12 steps. And at that time, it was only six steps. And the six steps that he derived at, based on his own experience in AA, was the same steps I derived at by moving away from the Christian steps or the religious steps. So that gave me a lot of confidence. But I generally don't talk too much about this because it's an opinion. I don't want to be controversial. I don't want to get people's backs up, because I know how strongly people hold views about steps. So I'm only saying this in case it might be of some help to somebody else. But I'm very secular today, but I'm not an atheist anymore. I'm a humanist. So my journey in AA has been moving from emanators to humanist. I've always thought being emanators is a bit of a, it's a bit of a position that's hard to maintain, to be against something that isn't there. You know, I said, don't call myself an Aferiist or in it. Well, no, I wouldn't do that. No, Aferiists are a little bit gentle. You don't fuck with the fairies, but I don't call myself an A. And a unicornist or it's not there. So for me, and this is just for me, being an agent was about things I'm against. Being a humanist is about things I'm for. It's things I'm attracted to, and I like the human being. Every human being, I like the world of imagination, of the imagination world. I like I like art and culture and music and art, poetry, the whole of the human world. So that attracts me. And for me, in this lifetime, it's enough. That's enough. There's lots of other threads I could talk to as well. And one of the important ones that I started in my once I put down the drugs and the drink was another important thread to being sober was an education. I never had an education. I left school without much of an education. So I went back to school and went to college, and have done a lot of education since I've gone to school, and that's been really important for me. And it's given me a view on the world, and it's given me some confidence in myself, it's given me confidence in my own mind, and being able to express my own opinions. Another thing, I never really worked in my life. I was very good at a fraud, and I managed to live by a fraud. God, I was never caught. I don't know how they never caught me, but I managed to live and to be able to drink and use drugs and do all sorts of things, and it never worked. When I put the drink down, and I went to a government training course in London and learned to be an electrician, and then I worked for an electrician in a couple of decades, and that was really important. So I felt like I was working, I was in doing the life of a sober person. I was living a normal life, and I was earning my wages. I wasn't stealing, and that was very important to have that life. And then around 20 years ago, I thought, well, I'm, being our sparks is a young man's game. It's a great, it's very good money. And it was lovely being a sparks to be able to travel around the day in my van and work. But it got harder and harder, and I've bad knees. And so I thought, well, I will do something else. And I used to sponsor a guy who was a psychotherapist, and he couldn't stop drinking, and I was a sponsor. And one day we had a conversation about therapy, and I said to him, and in my own recovery journey, I'd done lots of therapy, and I found it extremely helpful. And I thought, I'd love to be a therapist, and I said, but I couldn't. I'm way too fucked up. I could never do it. And he said, and these words, it changed my life. He said, well, we're all wounded healers in this game, really. And that sort of opened the door for me. It opened the door in my mind. I said, well, maybe I can do that. And I began to investigate, and doors just opened. It was amazing. And so I trained at first as an addictions counselor, and then later on I trained as a psychotherapist, and later, and then now I work with complex trauma and the addiction. I've been working in that field for a long time, and doing research in that field, and trying to find the links between the addiction and trauma, especially PTSD and complex PTSD. So that's my area now, and it's really interesting. So I have a life now that I'm able to sort of give back. I'm able to live a purposeful life. And I've learned a lot about addiction. I've learned a lot about myself, of course, you know, on this road. And I've had quite a lot of ideas now, you know, of how to, you know, be able to help people. I'm sort of, there's loads more stuff I can say. So I start to wind up now because I've spoken for almost half an hour, and that's a long time. And I know that are people here who want to share. Today, I'm a human being. I'm an ordinary, decent human being. I'm not subhuman anymore, who's fantasizing about being a superhuman. I'm just human today. I'm a human being. For me, that is extraordinary. I'm not just saying that because it's one of those things that you say. For me, being sober, an ordinary, decent citizen, it really is extraordinary. And I'm that comes back to me day by day on a daily basis. I'm extremely grateful for the women and men who reached out and helped me and supported me. And I'm extremely grateful to AA. I'm extremely grateful that I'm sober. And you know, that's very, very, I'm very conscious of that, of the gratitude of being sober, of being able to live a life. Yes, the landscape of my life isn't, you know, it's not Hollywood. You know, the landscape of my life has got a lot of dark patches. And, you know, there's a lot of darkness still in my life, in the garden of my life, in the landscape of my life, there are dark patches. And I don't grow things in those dark patches. I don't plant anything in the dark places. I just leave them, and I plant stuff in the sunlight, you know, where it's green and where the sun, and that grows. And so now, you know, I'm aware that there are lots of patches, and I'm constantly working on that, you know, on the stuff on the shadows from the past. It's something I constantly work with, but and mainly my focus is on what works and what grows. And I'm 70 now. I'm thinking of death. You know, that's another area. I'm allowing that in. I'm opening the door to my own death, and thinking about that, and feeling that, and wondering about that, and just being open to it, and you know, being with that fear, that fear of terror I feel when I contemplate death, and I sit with that, and I learn a lot from just sitting with that. Although let's hope that that's a long-term plan. No, I'm alive now, and that's what counts. Like all these threads in my life, you know, all the different, and there's lots more. They've all, like it seems that they've all woven into sort of a tapestry now that is, it's quite rich. It's not threadbare. It's not an old carpet that you chuck out. You know, it's our tapestry I have on the wall in my imagination. I have this rich, it's our tapestry of all the different threads, and that's my life and all the different things I did. And, I'm grateful for all of that. And because of all of this, my recovery today is rock solid. It's solid as the granite in the Dublin mountains. It's rock solid. And, it's been tested again and again. People have died. I've lost things. I've lost loads of things and loads of people. It's been tested again and again. And it's never even shaken. So it's rock solid. Just for today. You know, just for today. So just for today, I'm effectively cured. Alcohol and drugs is not part of my life. It doesn't have to be part of my life. I can live a life free from alcohol and drugs and the consequences. How that's going to be in a month, in a day's or weeks or a month's time, I don't know. But I know that today with utter certainty that I'm going to go to bed tonight sober, and I'm not going to pick up a drink. And whatever happens, I know I've got resources inside me to be able to find a way. And that is, you know, as they say, a life beyond my wildest dreams, because I never thought I could be just, you know, ordinary. You know, and that for me is, and that's it. Okay, guys, I've rattled on long enough, so I'll stop this now. And thank you all, guys, for helping keep me sober today.